Der Geruch in una berushutet adokusho Migin yaravid in una ijavit Kiman norpat Biyarar puti Gerin ne kanak Nenya
Hello and welcome to the Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, sitting in Annapolis, Maryland. It's about 7 in the morning, and just got back from a boat delivery. It's delivery season this time of year, so it's sort of the mass exodus. Boats from the East Coast are heading down to Florida, the Bahamas, the Caribbean, and then in the springtime they all come back up again. So this is one of the times where I make my money. It's a short season. It starts November 1st because insurance companies won't let you go down any sooner than that. But just got back, took a 50-foot Hinckley, a sou'wester Hinckley, down to Florida. Hinckleys are beautiful boats. I've been delivering this boat with a friend of mine for, 6 years maybe. I mean, I think I've sailed the thing about 7,000 miles. And, every marina you go to, you show up with the prettiest boat in the marina. You know, and even like if you're going down the waterway or something and pass by a boat, people will yell at you about, oh, that's such a pretty boat, such a pretty boat. But Hinckleys are a lot of work, man. You know, you can put like 40 grand just into the varnish, you know, every 3 years. You know, owning a Hinckley is kind of like having a trophy wife. You know, I mean, she might be beautiful, but you're going to end up spending a lot of money, you know. So that's it. But anyways, you know, it's always nice to jump on a different boat. And you got to, you know, make hay while the sun shines. You know, you got to get in as many deliveries as you can because the season is short. You know, it only lasts maybe 6 weeks, maybe 8 weeks. And then basically it's over. Then all the boats have been moved. So if you're lucky, you get 3 deliveries this time of year. But it's one after another after another. And it gets a bit tiring, being at sea, believe it or not. I mean, I know I've spent 309 days alone in the ocean at one point, but still, you know, it does, you know, it's nice to spend some time on land. It's nice to try to, it's hard to get your life together. It's hard to have a life when you're always bouncing around out in the ocean. So anyways, I'm going to continue on with this story I was telling you guys. I talked about biking through Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Thailand. It was the first the first goal that I had set, and I accomplished that back in 2002. And so it was time to move on to the second goal, which was sailing alone across an ocean, in this case the Atlantic. I got back from that trip in Southeast Asia, and I was living in Arizona, in Phoenix, for a little while beforehand, and I was working, doing 12-hour graveyard shifts, and it's a crappy job, and that's how I saved my money to do that Southeast Asia trip. I worked for 9 months in order to bike for 100 days, basically. So I came back from that trip, and I ended up going back to Ohio and where I'm from, and, you know, I sort of fell back in with my old friends and sort of reverted back to my old ways a little bit. And they were all still doing bad things, I guess you could say. Yeah, well, selling drugs and things of this nature. And but they were like brothers to me. I mean, one in particular. But you know, when my mom ran off, I guess you could say, when I was a young teenager, and this friend of mine's mom sort of adopted me, but she had a problem with crack cocaine, and so, I mean, it was a lot of hard drugs. It was kind of a crazy time in my life. But anyways, you know, I could tell pretty quick that it just wasn't for me, you know. I just, I wasn't getting what I needed out of that situation. So I was actually sitting around one day, and I was with my friend RJ. We went to this house because RJ wanted to get with this girl, you know. She was kind of a scallywagger, but RJ loved those kind of girls, you know, scallies. And so anyways, we go to the house, and RJ takes this girl downstairs, and he's doing his thing. And I'm sitting in the room waiting for him to get done, and there's, I don't know, maybe like 5-6 other people in this room, and everybody's pretty much, you know, stoned out of their mind. And I don't mean stoned out of their mind from smoking ganja, you know, I mean like they've been up for days on crystal meth and and that sort of thing. So I don't know, I'm sitting there and you know, I'm bored, and and I just decide, you know what, I'm gonna buy a boat. And I stood up and I said it, I made like an announcement. I didn't even know most of these people in this room, and all of a sudden I stand up and I'm like, I'm gonna buy a sailboat. And they all just sort of look at me, I like I'm crazy, and I don't. None of them said anything back to me, and I just sat back down again. And you know, maybe another half hour later, my friend RJ comes back upstairs, and we get in the car and we leave. But I was true to my word; I wasn't joking around. So I stumbled across, you know, I started Googling different things and looking at different sites and at different boats, but I didn't know nothing about sailboats. I didn't have the first clue. So I bought this 1969 Coronado. It was a 25-foot sailboat. It was sort of the epitome of plastic fantastic sailboats. And so I buy this thing, but this boat is in Maryland. And I'm in Ohio. I'm in Columbus, Ohio at this point, living off of Cleveland Avenue, which was a really rough neighborhood. But I really liked the neighborhood, but it was certainly a rough neighborhood. So, and I had a Cadillac Fleetwood, '88 Fleetwood Cadillac, a big brown land yacht, and I had a girlfriend who was from Cleveland, and she didn't know anything about sailing. So, me and my girlfriend jump in the Cadillac and with a bunch of stuff and drive out to Maryland, and I'd never even been to Maryland before in my life. Drive out to the eastern shore of the Chesapeake Bay, to the old Dickerson plant. They used to make sailboats. The company went out of business. But anyway, so we're looking around for the boat, trying to find this boat. We're going to take it down. I had big ambitions at that point that were sort of not realistic, to be honest. I was going to try to take this boat down to like Venezuela, Colombia, then bring it up Central America, you know, Panama and Honduras and Belize and all that sort of thing, which it really wasn't the right boat for that. I mean, this was, like I say, this is a Coronado, a 25-foot Coronado is plastic fantastic. I mean, you really, it's not an ocean boat at all. But anyways, we're walking around this boatyard, and it's the weekend, so there's nobody around. You know, it's like Sunday or something, and we're looking around, walking around, trying to find this boat. And my girlfriend keeps pointing at these like 40 and 50 foot sailboats, like, oh honey, is this our boat, honey? Like, no, that's not our boat. You know, that's a 50 foot Beneteau or something. And we're walking around, and finally we find this boat that's completely overgrown by weeds. This Coronado had been sitting on the hard for 10 years, and it looked like it'd been sitting on the hard for 10 years, and it was just completely overgrown with weeds and whatnot. So yeah, you know, we start cutting down the weeds and getting the boat ready, and spent a couple of weeks in the boatyard. I sold my Cadillac for next to nothing. I mean, I sold it for a few $100 just because I had to get rid of it. I mean, what am I going to do with it? You know, we're about to sail down the coast, and it was a bombed out boat. I mean, I wouldn't pay $200 for this boat, let alone $2,000. These days, I mean, the sails were 30 years old. The outboard engine was broken. You know, I mean, it was sitting on jack stands forever. It was completely taken over by insects. You know, like there was dirt daubers and wasp nests, and it was just dirty as all hell. So, anyways, we cleaned it up, threw some bottom paint on it. All the wiring was shot. All the breakers were shot, and I didn't know anything about any of it. Like, I didn't know how to wire something, and Luckily, there was one guy at the marina who sort of showed me the ropes, you know, just gave me basic information. Luckily, sailboats are pretty easy, man. You know, 12 volt is easy. You got a red wire and a black wire, you know, positive and negative. It's about as straightforward as you can have. It's a lot easier than AC power, where you have three wires instead of two. So anyways, 2 weeks goes by. We get this boat in the water. We get another outboard. We get as ready, you know, as ready as we can, and we push out into the chop tank in the Chesapeake Bay. And the winds are really light that day. It was in this was in May. This was like early May of 2004. And so we push out, and we're basically, I run aground right away. I didn't even know what red right return meant. Like, I knew nothing. Like, I had one chart for the Chesapeake Bay, and I mean one chart of the entire Chesapeake Bay. Chesapeake Bay is like 150 miles north to south, and I had one chart. It was laminated. It looked like a placemat at a seafood restaurant. You know, you couldn't navigate with the thing if you wanted. It would be like, you know, like maybe there was 20 soundings for the entire Chesapeake Bay. I was horribly unprepared. So I come out, our depth sounder didn't work. I basically don't have any chart. I got this one chart of the whole bay. It was a joke. I didn't really know what red right return. I didn't understand the buoys, the red and green buoys, very well. And so we go out and immediately basically run aground. And luckily it was low tide. So the tide came up a few hours later and we were able to get free. We get out in the middle of the bay, and it's starting to get later in the afternoon, and then it's starting, you know, maybe around 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the evening, and the wind starts picking up. And we're excited because we've had such light winds all day, so we're sailing along. This is the first time I've ever been out really sailing of any as a captain. I'd been on a sailboat a few, you know, some times in the past, but this was the first time I was ever in charge of anything, and, you know, I hadn't done much sailing previously. So we're enjoying it. Well, it's getting dark, and then it gets dark, and I didn't have, as I said, very good charts, and I had a really just a basic GPS, really just said Latin long. A GPS, it wasn't like today where you have these GPSs with chart overlay. I mean, I didn't have anything like that. So we just go over to the side of the bay, and we drop anchor. See, I didn't even realize that you should, like, find protection when you drop an anchor. I mean, you should try to go into a river or go into somewhere where you're going to have protection. I just went off to the side of the bay and just dropped the anchor in the bay. And then we go to bed. And about 3 a.m, the whole boat heels way the hell over and things fall and crash. And, you know, the boat's bouncing around. And it happens so quickly. And I jump up and I throw the companionway hatch back, and I'm looking around and I see like lightning, like 180 degrees of lightning, everywhere, just crashing down. And the wind's blowing now, maybe, I don't know, 30 knots and building. And see, in the Chesapeake Bay, in the summertime especially, but this was sort of an early season, you get these storms that come through, and sometimes they come through at night, and they can blow like 60 knots. They don't last terribly long, maybe just a few hours. But when they come, I mean, they come like a freight train. Lightning everywhere, strong winds. So we start dragging anchor. And I had a pissy little Danforth anchor with like 3 feet of chain on it. I had such a horribly inappropriate anchor. But I had a bunch of anchors. So I started throwing all my Danforth anchors out. And I started throwing everything out, everything I could. I threw out 9 different things. You know, I had like a Coleman camping stove. I put a line around my stove. I threw that overboard. I was tying lines around winch handles, throwing those overboard. Everything I could get my hands on that looked like it might do something, I tied a line to it and chucked it overboard. So I was dragging all these different things through the water, and I'm still dragging anchor. Obviously, a camping stove isn't going to really work very well as an anchor. But something did catch eventually. And when the sun came up in the morning, we were just a couple hundred yards from a rocky shoreline, a pretty nasty shoreline. It wasn't huge rocks like you get in Maine or get in Greenland, but it would have been the end of the trip right there. So the first day I was ever a captain, not just did I run aground, but I almost lost the ship. I mean, really, in the first 24 hours, my sailing career nearly ended. And had I wound up on that beach and had the boat been, you know, broken and all the rest, I don't think I would have bought another sailboat. I don't know. I mean, maybe I would have, but, you know, chances are I might have just threw in the towel and been like, well, all right, I tried that and I suck at it or something. And so, yeah, it was a close call. And of course, you know, we pull up all these anchors and the camping stove and all this stuff I threw in the water, and we motor around into this little river. We didn't get any sleep that night, so we motor around in this little river and drop the hook, our little pissy anchor, and we spend the next basically 24 hours licking our wounds. And the boat was a disaster because the wave action was big. There's nothing to stop the waves, you know. The waves were coming across the entire Chesapeake Bay and slamming into this little boat. Yeah, it was a hell of an experience. But anyways, I got to cut to commercial break. I'll get back here in a minute.
Our aim at Street Invest is to put a trustworthy adult into the lives of street children so that they can support them in creating the most positive paths for their lives in the future. We work around the world, working on the street with the children where they are. For such a large group of children, the amount of funding available is tiny. Really, the funding that keeps organisations like Street Invest going comes from individual donors. Street children are the most abused, neglected, violated children, yet they are also the most resourceful, responsive, and resilient children that we could have the honour of working with.
For more information or to make a donation, visit streetinvest.org.
Hello and welcome to Ocean Research Project. I'm Matt Rutherford, Executive Director of Ocean Research Project, sitting here in Annapolis, Maryland, watching the sunrise. So anyways, I got through that first night. We didn't wind up on the beach. We licked our wounds. We got our boat sort of back out again, and then we headed back out into the bay. Spent the next 2 weeks sailing down the bay and sailing around. It was really sort of trying to understand, trying to learn how to sail, really, just by going out there and doing it. And more mistakes were made. I didn't understand sail trim. I didn't understand, like, you could let out main sheets. You know, I had my main sheets tight, like I was close-hauled. I had them as tight as I could have them the whole time. So I had no idea that, like, when the wind is on your beam or the wind is on your quarter, you should let out your main sheet. Like, I just always kept it tight. And I was battling weather helm so much that I actually broke the tiller. I broke this wooden tiller because I was fighting so much. It's really funny looking back at it. All I had to do was release the main sheet. And the sails were pieces of junk. I mean, these sails were 30 years old. They were baggy. They were like had a consistency of an old pair of blue jeans, you know, and they were ripping and battens were flying out of them. And, you know, so I would sew them back. I would hand sew them. Actually, my girlfriend at the time did a lot of the hand sewing. It was sort of a routine. And I didn't know you could leave your mainsail up. Talk about silly. Every single night, we would take the mainsail off. And instead of just, you know, pulling the mainsail down and tying the sail off, we would actually physically take the sail off completely and stow it down below. And I didn't have a roller furler on the jib, but, you know, it makes sense to take the jib off, but it doesn't make any sense to take the mainsail off. I didn't know any better. What do I know? And so we make it down, and, you know, if we have a few more basic, you know, incidences, but nothing crazy. And I still only have this ridiculous chart. But I get down towards Norfolk, and somebody tells me about Skipper Bob. Skipper Bob Anchorage Guide. It's like the Bible for the ICW. If you're going to be going down the ICW and you're going to be anchoring, if you have a Skipper Bob Anchorage Guide, and it's like a paper, It looks like it's not a professionally made thing. Like, you don't buy Skipper Bob at like West Marine. You probably have to get it off the internet. It's like a spiral bounded thing. Like, somebody prints it, you know, in their basement or something. But you can find it easy enough. And if you mix that with a MapTech chart book, the MapTech chart book will tell you the mile marker you're on. So let's say you're on mile marker 767, all right? And you're going down the ICW. That means you'd be in Florida, by the way. Mile marker 777 is St. Augustine. It's the Bridge of Lions in St. Augustine. So first off, it tells you all the names of the bridges, and there's a lot of bridges on the Intercoastal Waterway, and you're going to have to get a lot, some of them to open up for you. So it tells you all that information, tells you when they do it. But even better, it'll tell you if you're at mile marker 767, and you know it's getting late, and you only got a couple hours of sunlight left, you can look and say, well, what anchorages are ahead of me? And you'll be like, oh, well, here's an anchorage, you know, in 5 miles coming up at, you know, whatever creek, you know, Fishing Creek or whatever it is. Then it has a code system with a bunch of numbers. And so it tells you how good the holding is, how good the wind protection is, how good the accessibility to groceries are. I mean, it gives you all this great information about all these different anchorages. It's just a... So anyways, when I got a MapTech chart book and I got a Skipper Bob, it all of a sudden I had a good information for the trip down the Intercoastal. You know, you think about going offshore and you know, I thought, oh yeah, I was going to sail down to South America on this boat, but I didn't know anything. So we started going down the Intercoastal Waterway. Intercoastal Waterway has its ups and downs. The big problem with the Intercoastal Waterway, or the thing that bothers me the most, is that it's like driving down the highway, you know, all day long, 10 hours a day, red, green, red, green. And by this point, I knew what red, right, return. It didn't take me very long to figure out the buoy systems. But, you know, it's just you're always in the ditch, and you're always trying to avoid running aground and dealing with all these bridges. And, you know, it is a really good way to learn sailing in some ways. I guess not sailing, because you don't actually sail much, but it's a good way to learn boat maneuverability and the basics of that sort of thing. So we putter down the Intercoastal. One other problem with the Intercoastal is that people get addicted to it. So people just get used to motoring down the Intercoastal so much that they never go offshore. So there's a bunch of sailboats that just motor from Florida up to Chesapeake Bay and then back down to Florida and back up to the Chesapeake Bay and never actually go into the ocean. And sometimes you'll actually see sailboats where people have removed the mast because they don't even care about sailing. They just motor around. And, you know, if you just want to motor around, man, get a trawler. Like, don't buy a sailboat. Don't take the mast off your sailboat. I mean, that's like, you know, cutting its Johnson off or whatever. Yeah, don't strip your boat. We went down the Intercoastal, and we didn't have too many problems until we started getting near Charleston. And Charleston has these strong currents. And we still had these pissy anchors. I mean, you get a real strong current in Charleston. And we were north of it, and we went into this little river to spend the night. And there was already a ton of sailboats in this river. So all the good spots were taken, basically. And we had to go way down to the very end. We're like the last one in this row of boats. And we dropped the hook. We put out 2 anchors. And we end up dragging anchor in the night. And we wake up, and this is always a fun way to wake up, but we wake up with the boat flopping over on its side. You know, this sort of this happens when your water goes out and you're in shallow water. Eventually your boat loses balance and it just plops over on one side. So it plopped over, we fell out of bed. We're like, what the hell's going on? We realize, oh shit, you know, we drug anchor and we're aground in a shallow spot. And the boat was so aground, it was like completely on its side. So I put the dinghy in the water and we hung out in the dinghy because it was just more comfortable to sit in a dinghy than it was to sit on a sailboat that's laying on its side. And of course, mosquitoes were flying around, and I mean, it was a horribly uncomfortable situation. And I learned, well, hell, man, I got to get another anchor. This is crazy. So when we got to Charleston, I ended up getting a Delta anchor, which is a plow, a non-hinged plow. And I ended up getting some chain. You know, I got, I don't know, 30 feet or 50. I think I got like 50 feet of 5/16 chain. And now I had a good rig, or at least, you know, good enough for that boat. And, you know, we made it down to the Florida Keys. And that's as far as we made it, was to the Florida Keys. And my girlfriend ended up flying back to Cleveland. And I took the boat single-handed from the Florida Keys just back up to St. Augustine in northern Florida. Which, I, you know, it's still like a 400-mile trip or something like that. And again, it's mostly the intercoastal waterway. But it was my first single-handing. And, I made it back up without any... Nothing happened. I didn't run aground. I don't remember anything happening that was that bad. And I get to St. Augustine. And 2004 was a bad year for hurricanes in Florida. There was four hurricanes that hit Florida. Charlie, Gene, Francis, and Ivan. And three out of four of them ended up hitting me, basically. Now, I was in the Intercoastal Waterway, but I couldn't get into a marina. You know, a hurricane is coming, and you know a hurricane is coming because they're well forecasted. And the marinas wouldn't let me in because I didn't have insurance. Well, I didn't even know insurance existed, really. You know, I didn't know anything about sailboats. I mean, obviously, I was more experienced. You know, we spent like 3 months getting from the Chesapeake Bay, getting from the marina where we actually picked the boat up in the Eastern Shore all the way down to the Keys. So I had a few months of experience, but still, I didn't know. You know, they're like, you got insurance? And I'm like, you got what? And who's going to put insurance on a piece of junk boat like that anyways? I mean, it wouldn't be worth your while. The boat isn't worth anything, you know? I mean, why insure a boat that's worth nothing? So, oh yeah, we were hit by lightning at one point. I will take a step back talking about insurance. We were in Georgia, and in this Wolf Island Refuge, this little creek in southern Georgia, and we got up in the morning and we were going to pull anchor, and I looked out in the distance and I see this cloud coming, real nasty looking cloud, real black, nasty looking thing. And, you know, we go over and we start pulling anchor. I haven't seen any lightning or heard any thunder at this point, and it still seemed like it was a little ways away. And as my girlfriend was walking up to start getting the chain ready to pull the anchor up, a bolt of lightning came out from this cloud and hit the boat. I had my arm on the boom. It hit the masthead. And I had my arm on the boom, and she was right by the base of the mast. And I got knocked across the cockpit. She dropped so quickly that her chin busted on her knee. You know, she like split her chin a little bit on her knee because she dropped like a sack of potatoes. And she looks back at me, and you know, I'm looking at her. I can't really hear anything because the thunder was so loud. And we're just dazed, you know. We're like, what in the hell just happened? I didn't even realize I got hit by lightning at first. I go inside. I notice that everything is dead. You know, my chart plotter is dead. We did get a depth sounder at this point, and that was dead. Everything that was on. And I had, you know, we were about to leave. So, you know, I had turned all my stuff on. Everything that was on was now off. And I'm like, oh, shit, this is a bad sign. And so I go in to turn the VHF on to try to listen to a weather report. And the VHF won't work. And so I'm, oh, man, this VHF won't work. So I go out in the cockpit, and I look up at the top of my mast. And that sailboat, normally a sailboat has a metal antenna on top of its mast. For whatever reason, this sailboat had a fiberglass antenna, like the type you see on powerboats. And the top two-thirds of the antenna was, like, gone, just vanished. Like, it just vaporized or something. And the bottom one-third looked like string cheese, you know? Like, it was just completely blasted and splayed open. And it blew the antenna off the top of my mast, and it fried everything. It fried my batteries. It fried all my breaker panels. I had its solar panels on the boat. The solar panels survived, but the regulator was fried. Basically, everything was fried, and I didn't have any insurance. Like I said a minute ago, why in the world would you have insurance for such a crappy boat to begin with? And I didn't know anything about insurance anyways. I didn't know that was really something that people did because I was just ignorant about the whole subject matter. And we ended up going, you know, we were in the middle of nowhere. The outboard engine still worked. So we work our way back to the ICW, and we have to go down a little ways to get to a marina. And we didn't stop in marina. We only stopped in a marina once that entire way down. Every other night we dropped anchor, and this was the one time we stopped in a marina to try to just get things sorted out for one night. But going down there, I couldn't call the bridges to open on the intercoastal waterway because I didn't have a VHF. And so I would sit there, and I would try to find a dock or something, and I would drop off my girlfriend on a dock. She would run up to the bridge, knock on the door on the bridge, and say, "Hey, you know, can you open a bridge for us?" And she would run back down to the boat and jump back on the boat, and then we would go through the bridge. It was a pretty silly way of doing things, but, you know, if you don't have a VHF, and I didn't have a cell phone back then, I don't think. I don't remember having a cell phone. But a lot of bridges don't have cell phone numbers. You know, sometimes nowadays they put cell phone numbers on the bridge so you can just call them on your phone. But that wasn't an option. So, yeah, it was, you know, the funny thing about that story is, you know, there's people out there who've been sailing for 30 years who've never been struck by lightning. And I've been sailing like 3 months, and I got hit by lightning. So I've known other people that have been hit by lightning since then. It is rare. People do worry about it a lot, understandably so, but it is really rare. You can buy this thing you can put on top of your mast. It looks all fuzzy, and I don't know, it's supposed to be some ion deflector. I don't know if it works. I mean, I think that if lightning is going to hit you, it's going to hit you. I don't think there's a lot you can do about preventing lightning from hitting you in the ocean. And in this case, where we were located in Georgia, there was no trees anywhere. I mean, we were the tallest thing around for miles. And so, you know, I don't think there was much really we could do about it. But there is one thing you can do on a sailboat, at least advice that was given to me by an old gray-haired sailor. He says, take a pair of jumper cables, like the jumper cables you use to jumpstart a car, and connect one end of the jumper cables to a cleat on the mast and throw the other end of the jumper cables into the water. And the idea is that lightning, electricity, is going to try to find its way off your boat. So when you get hit by lightning, that electricity is trying to, you know, it doesn't want to hang out on your boat. It's trying to get through your boat. And the problem is it can actually blow holes through the bottom of your boat trying to get out of your boat. But if you put some real heavy-duty jumper cables, connect one end to your mast, the other end in the water, then maybe the electricity will go through the jumper cables into the water and it'll be more or less harmless, or at least some of the electricity will. And you know, this bolt of lightning would have killed us if it was a more of a direct hit, but since this bolt came way out from this cloud that was still some distance away, it was, I think, a smaller lightning bolt. Had it been a full-on giant lightning bolt, it would have killed us. But anyways, got to go to commercial break.
Hi, I'm Sarah O'Kelly, founder of Skipper's Review. I started Skipper's Review because I wanted somewhere online for my local boating community to make connections and recommendations. So now it's up and running. I've been getting out of the office to enjoy the Florida sunshine and to meet some of my members. Each week, you can hear me swapping salty tales with sailors, surfers, swimmers, divers, boat owners, and builders, anyone with a story to tell about their life and their relationship with the sea. So join me, Sarah O'Kelly, with Skipper's Review on Boat Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Ocean Research Project. Matt Rutherford, sitting in Annapolis, in Bobby Moeller's house. Got lucky generally speaking. They've been really nice to me. He owns Moeller Marine here in Annapolis, and they're taking a boat in the ICW. They're out there taking a motorboat down and enjoying themselves, and so I'm house sitting, which is always nice. It's house sitting, it's a nice house, it's waterfront property, I got my boat in the backyard, and for the next 2 weeks I'll be living in their house, and that's really nice of them. And this happened every once in a while when you live on sailboats. Somebody goes out of town for a couple of weeks and says, "Hey, man, will you watch my house?" And they're like, "Yeah, I'll definitely watch your house." Anything to get off that boat for a couple of weeks, especially after this long 5-month expedition, you know, 6,000-mile expedition I did this summer. But anyways, back to the story. So, you know, we got the lightning incident happened and, you know, running aground and all sorts of interesting things. And so my girlfriend left in the Keys. She, you know, there wasn't any problems or anything. You know, it wasn't anything like that. She just had to go back and go to work. And so I brought the boat up to St. Augustine. And as I was getting into before I got the lightning story, hurricanes were coming. It was a bad year for hurricanes. We had 4 hurricanes that year. And I didn't have insurance, so the marinas wouldn't let me in. So I had to ride out the hurricanes on anchor. And then there was 3 of them. It was Charlie, and then Francis, and then Gene. And it was a 3-punch knockout. Eventually, Francis filled my boat with water. Charlie wasn't too bad. I pretty much made it through that unscathed. The last one was Gene. And with Gene, the boat broke free of the anchors, smashed into a piling, sort of, which damaged the boat, and then wound up in a swamp. You know, when the tide finally went out, the boat was a long way from the land. I was able to get the boat back into the water again. It was a small boat. It was a lightweight boat. So basically, just took the boat using a Towboat US guy who was very nice. I had my unlimited tow package, and this is something I would highly, highly suggest. Anybody who goes up and down the Intercoastal Waterway in the United States, highly suggest you get an unlimited tow package with either Sea Tow or Towboat US, because that $130 or $150 or whatever it costs is worth its weight. I mean, it's like $2,000-$3,000 to get towed if you don't have that insurance, and it only costs like $100-$150. But I don't know what it is today. Back then it was like $100. I think now it's $150. But anyways, took a halyard from the top of the boat, heeled the boat all the way over so the keel was out of the mud, so the boat was basically on its side, and then dragged the boat through the mud on its side using a couple of, you know, big outboard engines on the back of this towboat vessel. But she was damaged. She was beat up. Everything was broke again. You know, after that lightning incident, it took me, I didn't have much money back then. I still don't have much money, but it took me a while to recoup the losses from the lightning. And because I, you know, like I said, I didn't have insurance and I lost everything. And so I finally started getting the boat back in order again. And then these 3 hurricanes came and everything, I lost everything again. And so I ended up getting rid of that boat. I actually sold it for next to nothing to a guy who lived in a truck. He was, I really feel bad about it these days. I sold it to this guy who was living in it was more like an SUV he was living in. And he did like, you know, construction work, and he had a little dog, and he was just a derelict individual. And the reason I feel bad about it, I mean, I sold it to him for $700, which even that was probably more than it was worth, to be honest. And but I feel bad because he ended up being the scourge of the anchorage. There was an anchorage on the south side of the Bridge of Lions in St. Augustine, Florida. It's now gone, by the way. It's all mooring balls. And this is something they've been doing all over the country. They're replacing really nice anchorages with mooring fields, which is mooring balls. So you can't anchor there anymore. And if you want to stay there, you have to pay like $25 a night or something to stay there. Part of the reason for this is the city is trying to make money. The other part of the reason for this is because of bums on boats. I mean, they exist. And this guy was a bum on a boat. You get these people who have, you know, they often have drug issues or they're drunks, and they don't want to work, or they don't work much, or they're living off of government welfare or whatever it is. And they buy these little shitty boats and they go and drop an anchor and they just live on the boat and they'll be there for years. And their boats are ugly, their boats are derelict, and, you know, they look like shit. There's crap hanging all over the boat, and they're getting drunk all the time and causing problems. And this guy ended up being one of those people. He didn't seem like that at first, but he lived on the south side. There was a anchorage on the south side of the Bridge of Lions that was, I don't know how many, maybe had 30 boats or 40 boats, had a lot of boats there. And these were like permanent liveaboards, And he ended up being sort of the scourge of the Anchorage, or the scourge of the Anchorage. But anyways, I ended up buying a 26 Pearson. You can pick up a 26 Pearson for pretty cheap. This one was a particularly nice 26 Pearson. The previous owner had spent a lot of time and energy getting this boat ready to take it across the Atlantic. Some story of, he's an English guy, he fell in love with a Spanish girl, he named the boat after this Spanish girl, and he was going to sail this boat to Spain to his love or something like that. And he was a helicopter pilot, and he ended up getting a good job, and just abandoned the boat. But he had done a huge amount of work to the boat, getting it ready before he abandoned it. I mean, it even had a hydrovane on it. I mean, it was had giant cleats. I mean, the guy really did a lot of work to it. So I picked the thing up, and you know, the goal now is to sail across the ocean. You know, sail across the Atlantic. And that was the goal to begin with. And you know, I put a lot of time and money into that boat myself. But the problem with that boat, being a 26-foot boat, was that I couldn't stand up in it without hitting my head. And, you know, of course, I could say the same thing about the Alban Vega I took around the Americas, but I just got tired of it. I would work on the boat all day, and my back would hurt at the end of the day because I'm always crunched over. And so I just got tired. I needed to find a boat I could stand up in without hitting my head. And I also wanted a boat with a diesel. You know, having a diesel engine makes a big difference. Oh, this thing just had an outboard. So I'm looking around, and I saved some money, and I ended up flipping a hurricane boat. There's a boat that got damaged in a hurricane. I fixed it up a bit, and I sold it, made some money. And then some other guy I know had a boat, and he just inherited like $200,000 from his grandpa when his grandpa died. And he was moving off of his boat, and he basically sold it to me for next to nothing. He thought it had engine problems. He's like, yeah, my Yanmar. It was a brand new Yanmar in this. It was like a Hunter 34. Yeah, a decent. I mean, I'm not a big fan of Hunters, but it was a decent boat. And it was just the impeller. He didn't have engine problems. His engine was overheating because he needed to change the impeller. You know, it's like a $10 fix. So I changed the impeller, and the value of the boat just shot up to 10 times what I paid for it, basically. So anyways, I had a little bit of money, and I didn't have much. I mean, it wasn't like I had a lot of money, but I had a bit. And I'm looking around. I got to find a boat I can stand up in. So I find this Pearson 323. It's a 32-foot Pearson, although it's different than a 32-foot Pearson. It's a 323. It's sort of a nicer boat. It's sort of medium displacement. If I remember correctly, it was about 12,800-pound displacement, 4.5-foot draft, but it had a pretty full, fairly full keel. It wasn't a full keel, but it had a pretty good size one. It had a skeg rudder. It was a good boat. But anyways, that boat got hit by the one hurricane in 2004 that didn't hit me, Hurricane Ivan. That boat was in Pensacola, Florida, and so it was a hurricane boat. So I ended up getting it cheap because it had got damaged in a hurricane. And at first, that sounds like a good idea. You're like, you know, I sort of fixed up a couple other boats, and I was getting better at doing that. I mean, I was far from being an expert. I mean, even to this day, I'm not going to claim to be an expert. I've installed about everything you can imagine. But, you know, I could get my way around a boat a bit with some tools. So I get this boat, and everything is shot. The engine's broke. The sails are shot. The rigging is bad. You know, I mean, you name it. The wiring is bad. It was just a lemon. You know, it was a bad boat. Now, to try to be positive about this situation, one good thing about buying a bad boat, or if you just don't have much money, generally speaking, and you get a boat that's cheap and that needs work, is that you're going to work on the boat, and you're going to do a lot of the work yourself. Because if you had the money to buy a $300,000 sailboat, you probably also have the money to hire somebody, a professional, to go in there and do the work for you. But when you don't have much money, you got to do the work yourself, so you end up learning not just how to do the work, you get a lot of experience, but you also learn your boat. So that guy who spent whatever, $300,000, and I'm not, this is obviously a generalization. I'm not saying that everybody who buys a $300,000 boat doesn't do work on a boat. A lot of people work on their own boat. But if you don't work on your boat and you're out there in the ocean or out there in some remote anchorage and something breaks, you're not going to be able to fix it. And it's not like you can pick up the phone and call somebody and say, hey, man, can you come and fix my engine or can you come and fix my wiring or whatever it is? Because you're in the middle of nowhere or you're out in the middle of the ocean. So it's important to know your boat. I mean, it's especially if you're going to be doing blue water sailing, if you're going to be out in the ocean, you really need to know your boat. You need to know every wire on that boat. You need to know all your plumbing. You need to know your engine. You don't have to be able to take your engine apart down to the pistons. You don't have to get that technical, but you need to know how to replace all the outside parts. You need to know where the heat exchanger is. You need to know how to fix the heat exchanger, the water pump, the fuel pump, injectors, your belts, your alternator. You got to know how to do all that stuff. So anyways, trying to look on the bright side, I learned the boat well because I had to replace everything. Of course, the flip side of that is it cost me a fortune. I could have bought two of those boats for the amount of money I ended up sinking into it. And it took me a few years to get the boat up to speed because I didn't have the money to buy all the stuff. And I didn't have a good paying job or anything. I was working in boat yards. I worked, did sort of odd jobs within the sailing community, different sailing related jobs. But I got the boat, I nursed it, and I got the engine going and sailed it over from Pensacola, Florida, across the Gulf of Mexico. That was my first real offshore sailing. Again, with this same girlfriend who I went down the coast with. And I had a monitor wind vane on the back. At least I knew enough to buy a good wind vane. But I had a monitor wind vane. And we go out and it's March. And we get hit by it wasn't a strong gale, but it was a gale nonetheless. And when we were getting rocked out there, and we were in the cockpit the entire time, and we didn't have a dodger or any canvas, so waves were crashing over on us, and we were cold, and it was, I don't know what, it was maybe 40 degrees outside and blowing 35 knots in the middle of the night, and I didn't know any better to check a weather forecast. That's how little I knew. In retrospect, I should have just looked and see what the weather was doing. I should have waited a couple of days, but I just left. I went out to sea without even looking at the weather forecast, which was a stupid thing to do. But I didn't know. It was ignorance. I was ignorant. I didn't know any better back then. And anyways, made it to Florida, get in there. We went to the Bahamas. Our engine broke in the Bahamas, and I got stuck in a place for 2 weeks surrounded by reefs with strong current. I tried on three different occasions to sail out of this area. The winds were real light for a long time that time of year, and I couldn't get out. I almost went on the reef. Eventually, a guy came into the anchorage who was a mechanic, and I traded him. I traded him an inverter. I traded him. I had some frozen steaks on board. I had a fridge on that boat. I traded him a winch. I basically traded him all the crap I could give him to have him come over and fix my engine. So he took my engine apart, he got it working, but the problems continued to mount, and we did make it down to the Exumas, but we had more engine problems, and we had to nurse our way back. We actually got stuck with a broken engine on the Grand Bahama Bank, which is a big area of about 12 feet of water, and we ran out of food, and when there was no wind, we had a broken engine, we ran out of food. We ended up having a passing sailboat come and give us a pineapple and a bag of rice. Eventually, we make it back to Florida and get towed into the inlet, get towed in by Towboat US. I had my unlimited card. And yeah, and then, get the engine going again, and then she left, and then I went out and did my first offshore single-handed passage, which started off a disaster, basically. But I'll get into that next week. So, check out the website, oceanresearchproject.org. We got some videos from this year's expedition, cool little short videos showing us doing the research. And I'm also selling boats. So I'm helping connect people with boats that meet your budget and your dreams. So if you want to sail around the world, you want to sail down the coast, you want to sail to the Caribbean, you only got so much money, whether it's $50,000 or $500,000. I would like to help connect you with a boat that makes sense for what you're trying to do. If you are interested in buying a blue water boat, give me a ring. It's 443-254-3909. It's 443-254-3909. Or just send me an email at matt.rutherford31@gmail. So matt.rutherford31@gmail. I'll help you find the boat that will be right for what you're trying to do. So you guys have a good week, and next time we'll talk about my first single-handed sailing and get into the transatlantic. I'm sorry, I didn't get into the transatlantic, my first single-handed transatlantic. I'll do that next episode. But anyways, I'll talk to you then.
Our aim at Street Invest is to put a trustworthy adult into the lives of street children, so that they can support them in creating the most positive paths for their lives in the future. We work around the world, working on the street with the children where they are. For such a large group of children, the amount of funding available is tiny. Really, the funding that keeps organisations like Street Invest going comes from individual donors. Street children are the most abused, neglected, violated children, yet they are also the most resourceful, responsive, and resilient children that we could have the honour of working with.
For more information or to make a donation, visit streetinvest.org.
Yeah.
through.
Kuya Nagurok, Kuya Nagurok, Kuya Nagurok.